Welcome to episode 41 of Gallifrey Public Radio. This week we take a look at an apple and a lemon and try and figure out how these two things go together. It's our look back at Series 7. But first, your hosts. I'm Jay Witten.
We need somebody who is more intense.
And with me are Melissa Mazza.
Perfect Whovian name.
And Keir Hansen.
The jockstrap of Rassilon is formidable and large.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 41 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we dream and hope and strive and wish and pour all our emotions and energy into a show that has become a part of our lives and our love for years, and get a little something in return. Tonight we're walking the breadth and scope of the Two Halves Made Whole, the seventh new series of Doctor Who. We bid farewell to the Ginger and the Centurion. We welcome in the Impossible Girl. And we seem to be a little fuzzy on all the other details. I am joining you tonight. My name is Keir. With me, as always, is Jay. Good evening, sir.
How's it going?
And the lovely and talented Melissa. Good evening, madam.
Hello, guys.
All right. Well, we survived.
Just barely.
Coming at us in fits and starts, as it did. We've had our highs and lows. And then highs again. We wanted to do a recap that, that allowed us to be able to look at the season as a whole, rather than getting down into the minutiae of each episode and how they were interconnected and how they handed material from one to the next to give us some sort of continuity. Instead of continuity, we had two halves of a season, and we figured we'd sort of take a look at it en masse. I thought if it was okay with you guys, we'd start. I posed this out to some folks that that walked this same journey with us, that were riveted to each episode as it released, went at it with all the enthusiasm in the world. Some of them drank the Kool-Aid and listened to the hype, and others took very tentative steps and just said, okay, I'm not going to go into this with any preconceptions. I'm just going to appreciate each episode for what it is, and I'll reflect on it later. Do we want to take a look at what they had to say first?
Yeah.
And then we'll jump in? Okay.
Yeah, so a lot of these people are actually our listeners that decided to weigh in on the discussion. They wanted to get their opinion in on what the overall feeling or the overall takeaway of the series was. And, you know, we had Soleil say that it's inconsistent yet rewarding. And I have to agree with him on that.
I don't think you can argue with that.
Yeah. And it's a great way to be able to cull it down to a short phrase, because knowing his individual responses to each of the episodes, as he and I would discuss them over the course of the series, he was always a very positivist towards just about every episode and say, you know, I could find things to take away from this. But if you really were to step back and see the forest for the trees, it was a little unusual. You know, the pace shifted regularly, and the amount of give to the audience versus expectations of the audience to just roll with certain things changed dramatically from episode to episode and even within episodes. So I can absolutely understand that inconsistency comment.
We also had some feedback from Trish saying, despite moments of brilliance, a lack of cohesion and consistency in both characters and story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Elaborating on what Soleil said, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, that seems to be a general theme, is everyone's like, yeah, it was great, but it wasn't consistent. It didn't have that glue that most of the series seem to have lately. Mm. We had Badger Spoon say simply, out of the red and into the black.
I think that nice little play on words from Badger saying that we're, you know, getting rid of a ginger and picking up a brunette, but I think he had he had subtext going on in there too. I want to roll back for one second. Trish was brought up an interesting point about the fact that some of the inconsistencies was actually within the characters themselves. And that's a really good point. I mean, even down to our fair doctor, there were issues from episode to episode and then within even single storylines where we were seeing either reactions or responses, especially with the Clara thread and the, you know, the trust or mistrust factor that seemed to be kind of all over the place for a little while. And and we didn't really know whether that was a matter of the presentation order of the episodes or just a very different writing style and different director that didn't really communicate with one another about making sure that there was a bit of a continuity there. I don't know. It goes back to one of our earlier discussions too, about the idea of the doctor constantly being portrayed as a monster or he's getting more, tolerant of violence and that discussion.
Yeah.
Because that's definitely an inconsistency with previous seasons. Maybe it was a character choice or maybe it was somewhere they were expecting to go, but, I don't know. I would have thought they'd either stick to it so that we would see it consistently throughout the episodes and say, oh, okay, well, he's going through some sort of a change of mind or a change of hearts or what have you, and this is actually a character shift. Or disregard it entirely and realize, well, this isn't our doctor. We shouldn't have written this in the first place. But they didn't.
Yeah, it just seemed to be something that was left kind of hanging in the air, like, okay, what do we do with this part of it? And we never got a response to that.
Right. Well, I think it just has to do with how he's going to evolve. Now we know that Matt Smith isn't coming back. There's going to be another doctor. Like, you know, which part of him is going to inform the next regeneration? Because I remember watching some classic Who and being shocked that I think it was the Tom Baker years that he was not, from what I saw, at all opposed to guns. And I'm like, no, the doctor like hates guns. He hates violence. But he didn't seem that way. So I think it's not necessarily that he's like turning dark and, you know, or anything like that. It's just that this is more more showing like the, not solely for purposes of 50th anniversary, but they've been going out of their way lately to make him seem like previous doctors. I don't wonder if that's just a thing. Like, maybe, like, the no violence thing was just 10-something.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that belongs to each doctor. I know, like, Sylvester McCoy didn't like violence at all, and he disagrees with Peter Davison and Colin Baker on that. He said that, you know, anytime they've gotten together to talk about it, that's something they disagree on. And, you know, like, he... Anytime they would give him something to do, like it, I forget which one it was, but he said in one of the episodes, the script said that the doctor picks up a bazooka. And he's like, no, he doesn't. Ace does. You know, and he pawned all the violence off onto Ace, which I think, you know, kind of made Ace a more interesting character because it gave her more to do than just scream and say, help me.
Right.
So,
anyway. One of the last contributions we had was from Will, who we also know as TARDIS Mini, and he brought up an interesting point. His perspective as a viewer, he's always been one to watch the show in the belief that it wasn't necessarily so much about the Doctor as it was about the development and the growth of the companion in his company. And the Doctor was simply a vehicle vehicle to get the companion to where they eventually end up. And he says, you know, looking specifically at the pawns, that's never been a truer statement. I can see it with the pawns. I can even see it with Clara's life becoming something that was, you know, going through her existence. You know, we're taking the Clara au naturel, okay, the one
Clara
we
Prime.
Know, yeah, Clara Mark One, and she would have just lived her life and been the, you know, the snarky little tart and the skirt and so forth and kind of gone through that, but she ended up with this with this existence that was responsible for the saving of the universe, really, as far as we kind of recognize it, because of the fact that she spread herself across time to save the Doctor, and the Doctor has that importance. I don't know if the development or the path of the companion has always been the primary focus of the show. In fact, far from it, if you go back into classic Who. Companions yeah. were just that, companions. And granted, they always had something to contribute. Well, in most cases, they had something to contribute.
Some of them had
But it was definitely not their story that we were compelled to follow.
No, with New Who, they've definitely made the companions far more dynamic. But yeah, I still don't see it as they're the ones that are central. You know, they're definitely an integral part of the story now. It's definitely not just, you know, plot device anymore, but I don't mm-hmm. know if I'd say that they're crucial to the story, or that they're, you know, the main focus of the story anyway.
The Doctor can be at least partially defined by the efforts that he goes through for the humans that he loves, and the humans are bettered for their experience and their, you know, and their opportunities in the Doctor's company. So it's symbiosis, but I don't think it's necessarily leaned that far towards one or the other, at least in New Who. Okay. Well, now it comes down to us. We three. We marry three. We band of Whovians. I'm going to step back because I do not want to be criticized for being critical. I know, as I look back and I looked at my notes from each of the episodes over the course of this series, I probably put more things in the boo column than I did in the yay column. But it's not that black and white. So I'm going to step back for a minute and just listen to y'all kind of share your short and long thoughts on the way the series played out as a whole, from Asylum to you know, Name of the Doctor.
The thing is, though, I've said boo more. I can't do the perfect Princess Bride impression like you did.
Boo! Bow down to the Doctor of Slime.
Doctor of Depressants. Oh my god. Anyway, I disliked more episodes this whole season than I did than episodes that I liked, essentially. So and we've talked about all this before. So I think we've talked about each particular episode. We know each other's opinions on them. So I think the way to frame this is more of the overarching thing that was going on in the whole series. You know, because, you know, we've talked about this before. We know each other's opinions on episodes unless they radically change. And then, you know, let's definitely talk about it.
Well, but, yeah, I mean, the difficult thing is that there didn't see, you know, it's hard to look at this series as a whole. I mean, you know, it was so clearly divided, you know, not only in the time frame, but in the tone of it. You know, if you watch the first five episodes with the Pawns, and then jump immediately into the second half of the series, it's such a jarring change that it's hard to look at it as a whole and say this is one continuous thing that was supposed to happen. They tried to separate the season and did a very good job of it, too good. Yeah, I mean it lacked a unifying force.
Yeah, you know, okay.
It could have easily had one with Clara. I mean, you introduced her in Asylum of the Daleks, so you could have had that stretch all the way throughout. Or, you know, with the first question that was introduced last series, you know, instead of just bringing it up in the very last episode, have that be something that fed all the way through. You know, instead, it's like we've got a collection of essays written by, you know, all these different people who only vaguely have an idea what the theme is supposed to be. You know, it just seemed very disjointed and, you know, just like, hey, let's throw out 13 stories about the Doctor and that's the only guideline we're going to give the writers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if you were to just go back to Series 6, you'd have something that did not have the same range between the peaks and troughs, so that you didn't spend very long saying, I don't really know where they're going with this, or I don't really know how these are supposed to be interconnected at all, or I don't really feel, you know, or a lot of the things, a lot of the kind of concerns that we had through this series. Last series, we had either consistency to the threat, consistency to the villain, consistency to time constraint they were within, or some overhanging elephant in the room question, obviously the death of the doctor in the first episode and, you know, and that sort of thing to kind of drive you through. I mean, we had a through line that was cut and dried.
Yeah.
And there were episodes that treaded on it very lightly, but while it touched on.
But they still touched on it, and if they didn't touch on it overtly, it was a good enough story in and of its own right that it didn't sit there and think, what does this have to do with anything that's going on right now? It was still close enough to the core that you could, you know, it didn't feel jarring in the fact that it's like, yo, wait, he just hated Clara and didn't trust her in the last episode, and now they're best pals, and in the next one he doesn't trust her again. What the hell's going on? You know, it felt more like a continual story last series.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. I mean, even in some of the episodes that were, I'm referring to season or series six at this point, even some of the ones that were a little more, as you said, that were kind of one-offs, you know, like Night Terrors or the Rebel Flesh or something like that, that seemed to be a little bit more removed. There was something inserted in them, or there were at least some points within there that reminded you that there were other things going on that we needed to be genuinely concerned about. Even if they weren't going to address them, it was just a little drop of the needle on the record to remind us that that's still going on and we haven't dismissed that. Or in a lot of instances, like the doctor's wife, it wasn't necessarily one that had anything to do with some of the primary concerns taking us through the Impossible Astronaut theme that ran start to finish. But the episode was so stellar that you didn't even have time to think about it, nor did you give a damn, because it was just that good.
Right.
Yeah.
When we go ahead to 7, you know, we get something where I sort of looked at it as, if you remember from your high school mathematics days of going through and treating things like trigonometry and looking at the curves of sine and cosine and tangent waves, cosines start on a high. Halfway through the phase, they hit a low and they end on a high again. Okay, and you could have said that 7A followed that curve. Mm-hmm. You know, we started strong on a Solomon of the Daleks. Oh, a Solomon of the Daleks. It's confusing. We're on Skaro. Holy crap! There's major stuff going on. You know, we're inside the Parliament at this point.
Yeah,
we've got this strange occurrence of this girl, and we find out at the end of the episode, holy crap, she's been a Dalek the whole time. What does this mean? And then we start to slide into Dinosaurs on a Spaceship and Town Called Mercy, and Power 3 was okay. It was getting a little better because we had, you know, the Briggs daughter, and Unit is back, and we've got some kind of humorous moments with the Doctor, but yet some kind of heartfelt stuff too, and it's very camaraderie, and we think that that's great because we know we're going to lose the Pons in the next episode. So that kind of brings us around again, and we're coming out of that trough, and the Angels Take Manhattan right in the gut. It gets you. And then you think, holy crap. And we go into the break thinking, okay, we're back on our feet. You know, things are going to be all right. We come into the snowmen. Now Clara's there. It's a little confusing. We don't really know what's going on. But we've got some great moments with the Paternoster gang. And things are a little weird, and then we get to Bells of St. John, and it starts to slide again. Rings of Akaten, Cold War, okay, fine, but really had nothing to do with anything.
Yeah,
and it wasn't like Doctor's Wife. It wasn't a canned episode that was so stellar that you could forget what we were missing. In fact, I think some of our comments were,
how come Claire all of a sudden is really subordinate, whereas in other episodes she was really kind of take charge and kick ass, and now she's acting differently? Is this the same Clara that we had? We wanted a connection.
Yeah.
You know, we wanted that to still be part of the, we're supposed to have a Clara mystery on our hands. We want that through line. Hyde, decent episode. I liked it. But again, no connection to past or future as far as a mystery that we've been wanting to chew on.
Mm-hmm.
But then we start to, you know, kind of pick things up. We think, oh, Journey to the Center of the TARDIS has got a lot of potential. It's got some crazy stuff's going to be going on here. We're going to get some of the fanboy moments we've been waiting for a long time. And it was odd. I think that one was probably one of the anomalies. That's one of the ones that we could say if we had more episodes like that through the latter half of the series, I think it would have been okay with Seven as a whole.
Yeah,
because it wasn't.
If we'd had some that were not so, or had some that seemed like they were okay on their own, and I mean that one had some of the okay. At least they're addressing the issues now, and they completely erased everything that they had done. But at least they said something about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So and then we hit Crimson Horror, and we don't really know what happened there. I still don't know what happened.
I like to call that one rock bottom.
Yeah. and the Nightmare in Silver. Oh, fine. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm still okay with the episode. I'm all right with it.
It wasn't as good as we were hoping it was going to be, but it was still better than everything that surrounded it. Well, with one or two notable exceptions.
But then we come back in to the finale, and it's like throwing yourself in the treadmill after you've already gotten it up to sprint speed. You know, you weren't prepared for it. You didn't stretch first, and all of a sudden you leap onto the thing, and you've got to be sprinting, and you're enjoying it. Oh, my heart's about to explode. This is really exciting and invigorating. But you were not prepared for it.
Yeah.
So you come out of it with your head spinning. I don't know. This whole the series as a whole, if I were to look at it, Pons and Clara included, I think the friends of ours who had their synopses about inconsistently pretty much hit the nail on the head. We don't have a theme at all. No semblance of a theme whatsoever. You couldn't even say the theme is companionship or anything of that sort, because even that seemed an afterthought in a lot of these episodes.
Yeah.
It wasn't about the Doctor being in a particular frame of mind, because he was all over the place. So it wasn't like, you know, a Tennant season where we had, okay, we're in Dark Doctor, and we're going to be in Dark Doctor for a while. Or we're in Happy-Go-Lucky Doctor or Mystery Doctor or something of that sort, because he was all over this year.
Yeah, and I think that part of that is the fact that we had new writers. I mean, Moffat is trying to bring in some new talent, and they were, you know, they all came in with, you know, it's like, oh, I'm going to wait for Doctor Who, and I've got these great ideas, and nobody gave any thought to making sure that it was a consistent idea. It was just like, I'm going to go in and I'm going to write the best possible story that I can and, you know, show off how good I can be, instead of coming in and saying, let's work together as a team and make the series the best it can be. Yeah. You know, and that's something that I think we will eventually, you know, if these guys continue to write for the show, that, you know, they will be able to do that in the future. It's just going to take time. I mean, Moffat is, you know, basically working his farm team right now. He's trying to make sure that, you know, they've got, you know, a consistent flow of writers, you know, new talent coming in as, you know, as the show moves on.
Mm. It's It's interesting. You talk about some of the writers that he's trying to give these opportunities to. I mean, Chris Chibnall, I'll cut the man a lot of slack because he has a proven track record of being able to pull together good episodes when it really comes down to when he's given the opportunity to do so. And some
Hyde was a great episode. I mean, I thought that was a really good episode. It showed a lot of potential. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was just Rings of Akaten that kind of brought the score down. You know, that dropped his batting average.
Right. I'm still waiting for Toby Whithouse to put together something that I actually enjoy. You know, when I look at some of the stuff he's been given the opportunity to write, I mean, I didn't particularly Mercy. I felt it was the Wild West RoboCop flop of the first half of the series. In fact, it was probably my least favorite. I actually prefer Dinosaurs on a Spaceship over Town Called Mercy.
Wow,
which says a lot.
Yeah, it does.
And I don't really know. I don't know if I could really justify or explain in short terms why that is. I think it's just a general kind of taste in my mouth that I got after the entire thing. I think there were some fundamental issues I had with Town Called Mercy that bothered me. And at least Dinosaurs on the Spaceship, while I kind of felt that it was what it was. I think it was just a matter of it got kind of given to us at an odd point in the season where or maybe even in the wrong season for us to be able to accept the kind of goofy romp that it was. I might have been able to better accept it maybe in an earlier series.
Yeah.
But looking at Whithouse specifically and think, okay, well, some of the other stuff that he's written, he did a little writing, I think he did some writing for Torchwood, but he also wrote The God Complex last series, which was the one in the hotel, mm-hmm. which I thought was kind of a weak point for that series. I'm like, well, they keep giving this guy at bats, keep giving him the opportunities to really put together something that impresses us, and I'm not feeling what he's writing on any level.
So, Melissa, what was your take on this series?
The series as a whole.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah. No, I agree that it should be taken as two separate entities. And I think that's how we should refer to it from now on because, 7A and 7B works for me. It was they were trying very hard to be like movies in the first few episodes. And I kind of have to agree with Kira. I'm starting. Well, my microphone slipped. Hang on. I'm starting to like Dinosaurs on a Spaceship more than Town Called Mercy. I think A Town Called Mercy was actually my least of the whole season. Like, I liked Crimson Horror. You said that was rock bottom.
Wow, you like Crimson Horror better than that. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, stick to your guns. I give you credit.
But, I mean, in general, I like the Pond stuff better than the Clara stuff. So just because I liked, a couple of Clara episodes or moments in those, I'm still definitely, I think that Series 7A was... I think it was better than 7B, definitely. More consistent.
Mm. All right. Well, I think that now that we've, sufficiently crapped on the entirety of Series 7, I think we should have a little bit of fun. And at the beginning of the year, right after the Christmas special, we talked about what we thought Series 7B was going to bring us. And we had lots of speculation and lots of theories. And I thought it would be fun, now that we're on the other side of it, to go back and revisit some of that and see how we did. So let's take some time and revisit some of our theories.
Do we get to go, bilu, 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 bilu?
I don't have that one loaded. Dang.
Damn.
All right. So first, let's try this one first.
And on a related note, we know now that we will not be seeing Rose in any of the 50th specials.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was a big big no.
Yeah. Rule number one, Moffat lies.
Exactly. Yeah, so that was definitely some misinformation that we had gotten. So,
and we took it as gospel.
Oh, yeah. We did. So... then we were talking a little bit about what we expected from Clara this series.
What is the deal with Clara. I really think that this is going to be a big through point for the rest of the series.
Yeah, didn't get that one right either.
If you would just phrase it, I think it should be a really big through point for the rest of the series. You'd get your gold token.
Yeah, that would be better. But yeah, that's not what I said, so I get a no on that one. All right, and here's Kier talking about what he thought we were going to get about Clara.
I have a feeling we're not going to get anything concise for quite a few episodes in.
Yay, you got one.
That's true.
So, yeah, it would have been better had you said till the end of the series, but yeah.
We will get absolutely nothing until the last 15 minutes of the entire series.
Yeah, so then we started getting into some of the actual episodes.
Unfortunately, though, because this is the first one after, you know, Clara died, it's probably going to focus on the Doctor finding her and then trying to figure out who she is.
I'd say maybe like half credit on that one.
Oh, because that's legit.
Yeah.
It seemed a little bit loose on any kind of plot. Really, when you look at it, it's like, okay, yes, he went to find find Clara, and then it was just all like running around in motor scooters, and you know, it seemed to lack any kind of direction after that.
Well, that's finding her versus finding her, you know.
Yeah,
it's like finding yourself. It just take it as translated. It's good.
Yeah. So then we got the Rings of Akaten.
Filming reports from the episode reveal that some of the story is set in the 1980s.
Yeah. Maybe it was. I don't know. I mean, it's who knows what time frame it was when we were there, but there was nothing to lead us to believe the 80s. But
well, I think, no, there was as we had Clara growing up. Didn't we have a quick point in her childhood?
Oh, was that Rings of Akaten? Yeah.
Maybe those were some of the only ones that were released on set photos. When she was in her, you know, in her whatever primary school years.
Yeah, I guess so. So then, let's see. We didn't really have any guesses on Hyde. Everything we had was pretty much just, you know, given to us, or you know, we didn't really have any guesswork on that. So then we get into Hyde.
I would imagine something, you know, just turn of the 20th century or so.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. You know, the late 1800s.
Yeah, so that's not it.
No.
Yeah, so, yeah, we definitely got that one wrong. They actually put it in the 70s, so.
It's just like the 1800s. 1900s, it's just a little different.
Yeah, a little bit. Slightly. Just a little.
The costumes were still weird.
Yeah. So then, let's see. I think that's... Dang it. I should have put these in order. I really should have.
Let's just hear it.
All right. So then we got to talking about the Crimson Horror.
So this episode is going to be another Holmesian kind of mystery story, don't you think?
I say we give it to her. that was fairly close. I mean, it's...
Yeah, it might not have been up to Sir Conan Doyle standards for
I was thinking of the 1890s, just like you guys. That's what.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so, yeah, that was... Well, it was closer than we got, so...
Yep.
Here's some more speculation on Clara.
I think she's going to be more akin to, you know, Oswin. She's going to be more similar to Oswin's character of the, you know, computer genius, really quick and, you know, not shy of speaking her mind at all.
Yeah, there we go. We'll say half and half, because she definitely grew into it, but it took a lot longer than it should have.
Yeah, well, with the at least the Clara that we were following,
yeah.
There may have been other ones scattered through that were computer geniuses from birth and others that will never know what a computer is over the course of their entire existence. So,
yeah, but I can't claim credit for guessing it, all of them, that early on. So. So then we start heading into the finale.
But it looks like Alex Kingston is set to be part of the Series 7 finale.
Hey, we got that one.
Thank God she was in there, too.
Yeah. I mean, that was... I'd say that if they hadn't had her in there, it would have been a completely different creature. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize at the time how important she was going to be to that episode. But yeah, thankfully, she was definitely in there.
Right. So.
It's possible that they go with the, you know, the first question, the fall of the 11th, the, you know, the Fields of Trenzalore, that whole thing that they were touting at the end of last season. I mean, they were really building that up, and then we haven't heard anything about it this season.
Nicely done, sir.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, in retrospect, it's like they really had to go with that for the series finale. I mean, there wasn't any other choice. But
you had no choice. The fans demand it. Give me answers. Give me death.
So then we got to talking about how the series was going to finish off, like what we were going to get out of the finale, and this was my take on it.
I really think that they're going to use the finale of this series to, you know, to lead into that. I mean, huge cliffhanger, huge question mark, whatever it is. I mean, this episode is going to be the most brutal in terms of, you know, cliffhanger.
Spot on.
I did not realize how right I was going to be on that.
I didn't want to be that right. I was painfully right. No.
I was thinking, you know, 3-inch question mark, not 4 feet. Yeah. Yeah, so we did a lot better than I expected we were going to.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, definitely a completely different experience on this side of it though.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I went through this entire series expecting Clara to be a weapon of a malicious intent, you know, whether she expected it or not. And while she and the Great Intelligence were, you know, latched in terms of their respective fates, they were not partnered, as I had thought that, you know, if I were the one penning it, I would have said that that would have been the, you know, the solution I would have come up with, the whole idea of the multiple instances of sending the perfect weapon into the Doctor's confidants and so forth. But, okay. I mean, like, as I said, when the finale came around, I'm totally okay with the explanation that they gave and the way they went about, you know, resolving that. I don't know what that means going forward. I don't know if we're going to continue to get any sort of a mention of the fact that everybody is cognizant of what she did and the sacrifice that she made. So does that mean that she gets some sort of reverential treatment, you know, from this point on, for as long as we have her? Or is that something that's going to persist into the next regen? Is he even going to be aware of the fact? Is she even going to really stick around for long after we have a new Doctor in the box? Yeah,
that's a good question. But, yeah, I mean, that's one thing I realized is that I kind of got thrown because I expected, okay, they're going to introduce Clara in the Christmas special, and then it's going to take some time for the Doctor to realize who she is. I didn't realize that, you know, he was going to put it all together by the end of that episode. I thought they were going to drag the mystery out some. So then get the reveal about who she is at the end of it. And I was like, okay, well, clearly they've, you know, stepped up the pace, so it's going to get resolved sooner than I thought. So I thought it was going to, be a much bigger part of the first part of the series, and then we got like nothing. So it's, you know, it was difficult to say, here's what we're going to have. And then Moffat threw like, you know, 5 consecutive curveballs, and it's like, you know, at that point, you don't know what the heck's going on. It's difficult to make a speculation from that point.
Hmm. Well, okay. Then I'm going to, now that we've been able to sort of bandy this about and we've looked at our before, during, and afters, I will pose to you two the same simple question that I posed to the friends of ours to get to elicit the responses that we did. And basically, and I'm paraphrasing what I had originally asked them, I said, can you look at the full extent of Series 7, you know, from Asylum to Name of the Doctor, and sum up your personal reaction to the series in a single phrase? Not splitting it into two, as we're so driven to do, because it felt like we got two seasons, two short seasons instead of one. But if you really had to look at the entire season, is there any single phrase that you come up with that can kind of encompass what you felt you went through as a viewer?
What the frack?
No, I mean, okay.
I would say that if I had to pick like a phrase, yeah, it would just be, you know, a complete lack of direction that ended on a high enough note to nullify that to some extent.
Melissa?
I think Fall of the 11th would be my phrase, because I think this is more of like a slow descent, like a, you know, he's not like, I don't know how it's going to happen that his doctor regenerates or whatever, but I feel like this season is more of like, you know, he says goodbye to the pawns are so ingrained with, you know, Matt Smith, his doctor. River Song, I doubt we'll see her with the next regeneration. You know, I think her storyline is finished because she's so intertwined with Matt Smith. So I think that this series is the Fall of the 11th, like his declining years. Like, he's learned all he's going to, and these are his adventures with Clara. But it's still like a descent, and like now a different evolution is going to come for the Doctor.
That's a good point.
No, I can absolutely see that.
What about you, Kier?
I think the only thing I can say to it is it's disorganized. It felt disorganized.
Yeah.
I don't think I necessarily had a lot of really inherent problems with any of the episodes to the point where I really wish they didn't make them, or that I felt, you know, that one could have been stricken from the record and the fans would have been, you know, none the wiser. But I think as far as, and it's not even so much a matter of expectations, because, I mean, we all have a certain degree of expectations, whether we own up to them or not. But just in terms of overall feeling after we've gotten them, that either they weren't presented to us correctly, or that we missed something, or that we weren't getting everything out of them that we, not necessarily even so much that just what we expected, but what we felt we needed. You know how we were talking about after the finale, we were saying how this was the kind of episode that, while it didn't necessarily need to be the scale that it was in terms of the, you know, the sheer mass of some of the material that was being thrown at the viewer, but just the fact that it had all of the components of what made a kick-ass episode. You know, old references and new, questions answered and more questions raised, you know, emotional highs and lows, you know, leaving you feeling a little, you know, bruised, battered, and confused, but exhilarated, like you just stepped off of a carnival ride kind of a thing. I guess I wanted more of that at regular intervals through the series, so that I knew that the creators and the showrunner and all of the executive producers and everyone involved with putting this together for a fan base that is so passionate about it would say, they're really, after all these years, they're still writing this for us. And I don't know if they are at the moment. I don't know if all of them are, I should say.
All right.
So, disorganized.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. I'd have to agree with you on that one.
So. Make sure that you direct all of your hate letters to Keir at GallifreyPublicRadio.com. That's K-E-I-R. I can take it on the chin. It's fine.
No, I mean, it seems like that is a constant feeling, though. It's not just you that feels that way. You know, everybody seems a little bit disappointed in this one. You know, we had Series 6, which was such a huge phenomenon, especially here in the States, because, you know, it's like that was our first real, like, you know, we're part of the Doctor Who experience. We were getting it on the same day. It was such a big thing here, and it was such a great series. And, you know, we're coming off of that, and we're like, okay, you know, we've got all these new fans, all this new stuff, you know, they're really paying attention. And then we get this, and it's just like, no, this is not what we need to bring more people into it. This is not what we expected after Series 6.
Yeah.
You know, it may have been a different experience in England, but, you know, here with the boom of new Whovians and the popularity and everything, to go into a series like this was, you know, was a definite disappointment.
Mm. Well, then... It goes back to one of the questions that I think I brought up with you guys over the last couple of weeks, which was if you're a showrunner, do you look at the viewing audience as a whole when you start laying these things out and holding some standards to the writers who are presenting your script material? Or do you look at the fans who are, you know, elbow deep in all the aspects of the show and its history and canon and discuss it as we do ad nauseum? Because if you satisfy them, then that means that the show is hitting a standard of excellence that will also win over the general viewer base as well, because it made fans of those people. So that's a great way to be able to follow formula, so to speak, and continue to win over new viewers.
Yeah,
but if you stray from that.
But then you also have episodes like the Rings of Akaten, which was very, very divisive, and it, you know, and Cold War was the same kind of thing to a lesser degree, where, you know, Rings of Akaten really appealed to people who were only fans of New who, you know, enjoyed the whimsy of it. And then you had Cold War, which diehard Whovians and fans of the classic stuff, you know, loved, because that's, you know, that's classic Doctor Who. That's what we come to know and expect. And the two did not mesh. So, you know, it's like, which group do you really feed to? You know, I think that the key isn't so much picking, you know, which kind of story you're going to tell, but just picking a story and telling it consistently. You know, have some definite hands-on control of the overall story, maybe not on an episode per episode basis, but definitely, you know, Moffat needs to get in there and say, this is the story we're telling. Make sure whatever you do advances that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I just tell an aside story? Someone I know said, I was like, have you been watching Doctor Who? And he said, I haven't seen any of Series 7B. But my roommate said, you have to see Rings of Akaten, and it's like one of the best Doctor Who episodes ever. I was like, really? Your roommate said that?
Well, you know what? Far be it from me to discourage anyone who's going to say that they're passionate about an episode, because it means that it's getting people to continue watching. Mm-hmm. And it ensures the continued growth of the show on this side of the Atlantic, and I have no problem with that in any form that it takes. Doesn't necessarily mean that I think the entire show should start to cater towards, as you were just saying, Jay, about the idea of going too far towards one side or the other. You know, work on winning over or consistently handing gifts to new Whovians, or do you go back to classic Who references and just pander to the old school fanboys all day long? There is a median in there somewhere. The finale was proof of that, because of the fact that we did have some references to some things that new Whovians would literally have to go back and do research to understand half the things that they were being shown. But they were getting so much out of it as well that even if they chose not to, they still had a wholly entertaining episode.
I think that, you know, where Rings of Actin really appealed to people who had no Classic Who history, and Cold War really only appealed to people who knew Classic Who, yeah, there were some in there that had just enough mention of classic stuff. I mean, the finale is a great example where they, you know, had some classic references, and it made everyone who was a fan of the classic series just, you know, bubble over with glee, but it wasn't to the point where it became, you know, exclusionary. You know, people who had no idea who these people were that were running around were able to be like, okay, no, I'm still enjoying the episode. I'll figure out who it is later on, but I can still follow the story without having to pull up Wikipedia. Yeah, so I think that if they can find that kind of balance where it's not, you know, we're going to write this episode for the new Whovians, we're going to write this one for the classic Whovians, it, you know, just find that blend, I think that's the best way to do it.
Yeah. Well, they have the opportunity as a result of all of the tumult that's going to happen in the 50th. And the fact that we'll be seeing Smith out over the Christmas special. Series 8 is a blank slate. I mean, it really is.
Yeah.
We don't know how long we'll hold on to Jenna Louise Coleman or how long we really want to continue with her. If she is really, in terms of all the aspects of the of her existence as we know her, because we're not going to go back and have some sort of weird glued together clip episodes where she goes back and we see her involvement with the previous, you know, the previous 10. That's just not ever going to happen. Nor do I ever want to see that even in animated format. So we kind of have to see her latched to 11. So unless they really come up with some creative way to make her relationship with 12 really not only plausible but heartfelt, I don't see her around for long. So that means that, you know, for a 12-13 episode season, however it proves to play out for next year or whenever we actually end up getting it, it's all bets are off. So I'm really hoping that he's got that Moffat here we're referring to has an idea for something grand, and that it's got some legs to it to last more than just an opener and a finale, and everything in between is lettuce and tomato. You know?
Yeah. So, do you guys realize that this will be the first time that we've had a companion be there to help with the, or not to help with, but be there throughout the regeneration since Rose? It's only been, you know, what, 3 doctors now, but still, it's like, that seems like a long time ago that a doctor was there to witness the regeneration, or that a companion was there to witness the regeneration. So I think that that will be crucial for forming the basis of the relationship between Clara and 12. Is the fact that she was there with him when it happened. So I think that, you know, with as close as some of the companions can get with a doctor, that feels like something that can really lend itself to, you know, to forming a really strong relationship. So
yeah, I definitely think that's necessary.
I mean, they've got a basis to make it fantastic.
Mm. And she's in a good position to be that anchor to sort of help pull him through in that confusion period that follows.
Yeah, especially if she can keep the memories of saving the doctor, or at least the emotional drive that she had in order to do it.
Yeah. That's going to be a really critical factor, is how much out of this whole ordeal do either or both of them really take away from where we've just left off. I'd be really disappointed if it's just a total reset of sorts, and everybody just accepts everybody, sort of the way we had by the time we reached the end of Journey to the Center, where something was kind of sort of nagging at the back of their minds, but they weren't going to talk about it anymore because everybody was just fine. I hope they both carry this through, because this is going to be something where I think it could be an interesting mutual respect and dependence on one another, which will make his departure that much more impactful, I think, on her, on the viewers. He deserves a good out. I think Smith has done a commendable job. And while it's never, while it is not going to be the "I don't want to go" kind of moment, I'd love to see him try. I'd love to see him try. I'd love to see Smith really make his monologue for whatever statement his doctor chooses to make as his as his final. If he gets that opportunity,
I think it's going to be more along the lines of Nine's regeneration, where it's just a simple like, you were fantastic, and you know what, so was I. Just something simple like that. I think is all that is really going to be needed. I want it to be more. It's got to be more heartfelt than it was with Nine, just because he's been around longer. We've grown more attached to him. We want something a little bit more than that, but it doesn't have to be the heart-wrenching, why does he have to be alone and blow up the TARDIS kind of regeneration that we had with 10.
Mm-hmm. I think it'll be closer to 9 than 10, and I'm okay with that.
I wouldn't be surprised if it picks up on the fact that a lot of the ways that 11 would handle some of the most grave situations is being unusually not aloof, but just sort of unpredictable. That idea of the quick switch of the lever and the swirl of the coat and the kind of see you around sort of approach. I wouldn't be surprised if he tries to joke away his final moments so that we don't really see, what he's feeling internally. He hides quite a bit behind it.
Act like everything's okay right up until the very end and then say goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
That definitely seems like something. Yeah. So. Well.
But we'll save those predictions for after the 50th.
Yeah,
I guess we need to know, where we're leading that, and then we can start really hypothesizing. Then we'll have a true betting pool going about how do we off this doctor? Was it the lead pipe? Was it the candlestick? Was it the revolver and the conservatory?
Talking about the ridiculous betting, so the endless picks for the actors to play the 12th Doctor has not slowed down, and neither has the odds and the betting and things like that. It's every website that you go on, regardless of whether it's tied to Doctor Who or not, has something about, this is who we think it's going to be. And, it's just getting ridiculous. It's like, you guys do realize that this is the decision of one person, and just for the sake of being contrary, he can be like, fine, you know what? That guy over there who's cleaning out the trash. Yeah, make him the new doctor. You can't bet on this like it's college sports ball.
Yeah, they're
sports ball.
Yeah, where you score a goal unit
exactly.
in the field net. he does not. There are no rules that say that he has to go towards any type, demographic, gender, race, creed, color, shape, size, species, anything. He doesn't really have to answer to any formula. This is not he's following some sort of a Google algorithm that says that he has to stay within these particular sandbox walls. So the idea of putting likelihoods on any name, let alone betting odds, is redonk. Oh, totes yeah. Redonk, bro. So, oh, I mean, God, we I can wish... And, yeah, boost the gain on it. I want that with like deep echo and reverb. Totes redonk, brah. But everything at this point is just wishful thinking. And it's really what it comes down to. And so that's why some sites are doing it with all seriousness and some sites are saying, wouldn't it be great if, you know, if Peter Dinklage was the next doctor or you know, if Tracy Ullman was the next doctor or go on and on. And they're all over the place. But fine. Yeah. Have a blast with it. And half the fun is just hearing people's theories as to why some malarkey name that they come up with, they think has some validity to it. It really has nothing to do with who they choose, just why.
One of the most amusing things I'd seen when I was looking around today was one of them, I can't even remember where it was, and I didn't want to write it down. It was, somebody said that, you know, they think that the next doctor should be Russell Brand. And the very first comment that you see after that is, what level of hell did you crawl out of? Yeah, no, never.
I would not tolerate Russell Brand.
Very few people really can. Yeah, I mean, we had some of the ones that we've thrown in as early thoughts. We've also heard that there are, you know, everyone from, the bring around the likely candidates from the last iterations when they were choosing 11 and so forth. And that's all fine. I mean, you know, maybe in the grand scheme of things, if you knew who had read for 11, they might have a better shot than many at 12.
Yeah.
Simply because they made it to the first round, so to speak, and they're not just names in a hat. But even beyond that point, it's a totally open playing field. So, folks, relax. Just relax. God, it's right now you're in Fun Factor, and we still have two major episodes to enjoy with Smith.
I mean, huge episodes. I mean, I'd say, you know, probably, well, definitely one, the biggest of his run, and the second one, I mean, that's going to be up there. You know, so, yeah, definitely just stop jumping the gun and enjoy what we've got left, and, you know, we'll see where it plays out. I mean, they've yet to cast someone as the Doctor that hasn't been, you know, tremendous at it.
Mm-hmm. You know. No. Do you each have sort of little short lists that you keep in your back pocket of I wish, I wish, I wish?
No. No, honestly, I don't. I don't know enough to say that, you know, I want it to be this person. That the only ones that I can really think of, I mean, I know everybody keeps on throwing the name around of Chiwetel Ejiofor. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but he played the operative in Serenity. Mm-hmm. You know, I could see him doing it. I could see him being okay. That's one that I'm like, I would think that was cool. The other one, I hadn't even thought about it until you mentioned it last week, Kier, but Robert Carlyle. I would love to see him as the Doctor. But beyond those two, it's just, I've got no clue. I'm just ready to sit back, wait, and see what we get.
Well, I'm okay with sharing who I kind of keep on my I wish or I'd like to see.
Who is it?
Carlyle is always going to be on there because I think he definitely has the ability to both play the seriousness and the witty, at times humorousness that I think the Doctor needs to carry based on where he's coming out of. But I would also, for a lot of the same reasons, also include James Nesbitt. If you have not seen most recently the Jekyll series that is available on Netflix, miniseries, I think it's either four, maybe five episodes to it. He's brilliant. crazy creepy, but brilliant. And you've also seen him. He was which one of our hobbits was he? Or which one of our dwarves in the Hobbit was he? He was with the goofy hat with the ear flaps. Who was that? I don't even remember. Had the conversation with Bilbo when he decided he was going to leave the company, and he talked to him and wished him well and said he was sad to see him go and so forth. But go ahead, look up James Nestor. And Tobias Menzies, Littlefinger from Game of Thrones.
No, Littlefinger and Tobias Menzies are not the same person.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, Tobias Menzies is who I'm referring to.
He's Edmure Tully.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, my bad. But I think he has... again, that combination of being able to pull the gravity and yet still be kind of dry, humorous as needed. On the female side of the card, because that seems to be on everybody's lips at the moment, just as it was when we last time we went through this dance. I would say that if you really wanted to put a powerhouse into that TARDIS, hand it to Helen Mirren. She would crush that role all day long.
That's come out a couple times, and actually one of our news items is actually Alex Kingston was on the BBC the One Show, and they brought that up to her, and she laughed about it and said, "Yeah, I don't know if I could kiss her."
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys used to watch MI5. In the BBC, but there's an actress, Hermione Norris, who's actually pretty talented in that regard. And she's that idea of playing that kind of catty, witty, but down to business and, you know, really kind of an interesting character actress. And Tilda Swinton, you might remember, she played the Ice Queen from the all of the Narnia films and things like that.
Yeah, and I think I think she's a little bit too big to be considered for the Doctor, but
yeah.
I think that she would be amazing. I mean, she's got that, and I'm saying this in the utmost respect, she's got that alien feel of she's just different enough that, you know, you're like, there's something odd but amazing about her. And she reminds me a lot, if I put her in the role of the Doctor, she seems like she would fit like the William Hartnell role. Just very, you know, aloof, very separate, but there's something about her you can't help but love.
Mm. Yeah. Then if I were to really throw my wild cards in just for the hell of it, Richard Coyle, who, if you remember, was Jeffrey on Moffat's Coupling sitcom series. He was the Welsh heavy drinking, always in trouble, had mother issues and things like that, and ended up deciding to leave the cast the situation that all of the involvement of those characters, because he was convinced that if he went to the Isle of Lesbos for vacation, he would be knee deep in lesbians. But Richard Coyle is a hilarious actor who apparently has done a lot of dramatic work since, and I'd love to see him come back around again, because having a Welsh doctor would just be kick ass. Isn't this all very exciting? It's very great, wouldn't it be?
Oh, jeez.
And then on the female side, Zoe Wanamaker, who we've seen in a thousand things, but you also recognize her as Madame Hooch from Harry Potter. Yeah, she was the Quidditch instructor.
She was also Lady Cassandra.
Yes, we wouldn't recognize her necessarily because she was just a piece of skin.
Exactly. So, yeah, she could come back for the role, we've already seen her in the show once.
But I love her because she is so unpredictable and near back guano crazy when the role allows her to be. I think she could make an excellent doctor. So there you go. There's my bizarro list. I've heard some other really good ones tossed around that really make you ponder for a little while. But right now, all for fun.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
Eddie Izzard. Eddie Izzard was a good one that came around a while.
I would love that.
Cross-dressing doctor come running out. I can have breasts if I want to. I can take them off when I don't want to. Yeah, it's great.
So there's not much in the way of news this week. I mean, like I said, the Alex Kingston interview, you know, the countless numbers of speculative lists out there. Also, the news from a little while back was that the mill who did all the visual effects for Doctor Who had shut down, and you know, there was the question of who was going to take over for the mill. They actually found Milk is going to be the new company handling all the visual effects, starting with Series 8.
Hmm. So, for what that means, might mean we have a different intro sequence. Might mean we have a different sort of an overall feel to some of our space travel sequences and things of that sort. They might want to put their own little stamp of style on these things. Might even mean that our regenerations look a little different. Who knows?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's going to be, you know, time will tell what impact this has on the show. But, yeah, I mean, the mill's been doing Doctor Who since, I think since its inception.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's, the mill shutting down was kind of a big deal. So, we'll see how this company does. I couldn't find anything on what else they've done to kind of get a feel for it, but I'm sure it's out there. I just didn't have time to hunt it down.
Right.
So for any of the intrepid listeners out there, if you want to do that research, you can send it to us, and we'll give you full credit. Really, we will. I promise.
Well,
but
give us your full name and how it's pronounced for inclusion on the air.
Yeah, but yeah. Aside from that, I mean, everything's just kind of, you know, dying down after the whole, you know, Matt Smith leaving stuff. I mean, that trumped all other news, and it probably will for the next week or so.
I think so. Yeah, both in reactions and hypotheses about, you know, oh, did he leave on good terms? Are we sure everything's really okay? I'm waiting for that one to come around.
Yeah,
is it because he shaved his head? Oh, ooh.
Yeah, and I saw a thing where they had asked John Barrowman what he thought of it, and you know, in not typical Barrowman fashion, he was like, "Yeah, no, it's not a big deal. It's, you know, I look at it like, you know, I'm very familiar with the show now, and it's a job. You know, sometimes you get done with a job and you leave it. It's not a big deal." And, you know, he's like, I hope Matt has the best of luck going from here forward. And, you know, it was just, he was very, very subdued about it. He's like, you know, I'm not crying over it. I don't think it's a big deal, but I do feel bad for the fans who've grown attached to him and have to go through this now. So it was a very well put together and, you know, calm reaction from him, which, you know, you don't expect from Barrowman anymore.
Well,
he's gone through all the stages of grief and he's not accepted.
Yeah. I mean, there's only so much you can expect him to say, seeing as how the fact that he never shared the screen with the guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is unfortunate. I mean, and a lot of people don't really come around to that realization. And for them, Captain Jack is kind of eternal. No pun intended.
Yeah.
But they kind of expect him, oh, he'll be around again. They'll write him back into the script. Well, they went through an entire regen of the Doctor without Jack not only not appearing, but not even mentioned.
Yeah. You know,
his character just isn't even referenced. I don't know if that's a personal grievance that Moffat has, where he just didn't like what was going on with the Harkness character, or maybe he thought, well, you got your own spinoff, so quit your bitching.
I mean, that may have been it. I don't know. I feel like the whole Harkness storyline, as far as the Doctor went, was kind of wrapped up. You know, I mean, when he left at the end of Series 3, it was kind of like, all right, yeah, I mean, that was a clean spot for him to exit the Doctor Who storyline. You know, yeah, you continue with the character in Torchwood, and he can grow from there, but he doesn't necessarily need to be involved with the Doctor anymore to finish the story.
Yeah, and we kind of did get his natural conclusion, face of Bo.
Yeah.
So we're kind of... Yeah. Well, even that's been thrown into suspect now, too.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Do you guys have anything else in closing?
No, I'm actually, you know, I'm kind of looking forward to what we're going to be doing over the next couple of weeks, too. So I'm eager to start doing the research on this stuff. Yeah. So let's move forward. And let's not reflect on the things that made us sad.
Absolutely. So next week, we're actually, we've got the 50th anniversary coming up. We've got the Christmas special, which is going to be introducing the new Doctor. You know, things like this are natural places to draw people into the show. You know, they're gonna get major attention. They're gonna be all over the place. So, you know, this is where new fans come from, is things like this. So we decided that we're actually going to take a look and pick, like, our Whovian starter kits. You know, what are the episodes that we think are good ones to start people out with, either to get them hooked to the show and get them sucked into where they can't leave, or, you know, here, you know nothing about it. These are the shows that will help you understand. Yeah, so we'll kind of have our five or six picks to get people started on it.
Mm. This is our primer set. Yep.
Yeah. So you can take these and go forth and bring new Whovians to the fold in time for, you know, the 5-month wait that we have ahead of us now.
Hey, and for the listeners out there, if you've pulled these sort of lists together for yourselves, or if you've gone through the process of trying to get somebody indoctrinated, like that, indoctrinated. Yeah, I'm coining that one.
Yeah, you know it's true.
Yeah, and you've gone through this dance before. Share your list with us. You know, why you chose the ones that you did. You say, oh, you know, I had a roommate or so that kept saying, oh, what's with the little stupid blue telephone booth that you keep over in the corner? Oh, it's not a telephone booth. All right, come on, sit down. I'm going to show you something. What were your go-to episodes? So, yeah. You know,
even if it's just one or two that you stick with, you know, I know a lot of people tend to gravitate toward Blink, but... You know, that really doesn't give you a lot of information on the show. Yes, it's a great introductory episode, but then you want more information. So, you know, where do you go from there? So, you know, here's the call for all you guys. You know, write us in, find us on Twitter, however you want to get a hold of us. You know, let us know what your episodes are that, you know, you use to bring people into the fandom. Yeah. And you can, you know, email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Find us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio. You can find us on Facebook, iTunes. You know, go to our website at GallifreyPublicRadio.com. Leave us notes in the comments there. There's a banner at the top. You can click there. It'll be real easy to send us a feedback using that. So all kinds of ways for you to get a hold of us and send us all your thoughts on it.
Yes.
And also, you know, go over there and leave some notes in the comments. You know, let us know what your thoughts were on Series 7 as a whole, you know, or if you can't look at it as a whole, you know, just share your thoughts with us. We'd love to hear what, you know, what you took away from it.
Please do. So, yeah, because that, again, you know, that always helps us not only steer the discussions on subsequent casts, but it also lets us know, you know, whether or not we are just kind of, you know, speaking from our own headspace, or whether we're sort of, you know, if you're agreeing with us, we'd love to know that, or if we're completely off the mark, we'd love to know that too, because it's the contrary thoughts from time to time that sort of remind us that there are other perspectives out there that we might not be taking into account for.
Plus, so, you know, what else are we going to talk about? We need to hear other viewpoints. We love to engage and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, this has been episode 41 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, thank God for a 50-year backlog to get me through this wait.
This is Melissa saying, I stand by. The Crimson Horror is better than A Town Called Mercy.
And this is Gear saying, you folks just wait. They're bringing back the umbrella. They're bringing back the umbrella.
Bring it back.
See you guys next week.
Allons-y.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. Have something you need to say, something we got wrong, or something you just need to weigh in on? Send us an email at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also find us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, on Stitcher Smart Radio under Gallifrey Public Radio. Find us on iTunes, where you can leave us comments and reviews. You can also head over to our homepage at GallifreyPublicRadio.com, where you can leave comments on each episode and get into discussions on the things that we bring up. You can also keep up to date on all the latest news and what's going on in the community. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2013.